Nicholas Watt. Government generates growth rather than the animal spirits of the vibrant private sector.
He loves emotive language, doesn't he?
If you told me the phrase vibrant animal spirits, of course, the first face that comes to mind is Andrew Neil.
Andrew fucking Neil. Oh, my God. Okay, have you finished breakfast, you knobhead?
Enough. Yeah, let's go.
Hello and welcome to News Club. It's me, your host, Tom B. I'm here with Tom C. And today, Mercedes, to ask the question, got news? This is the place where we talk about... That is a ridiculous tagline. This is a place where we talk about the news, but most importantly, what to do about it, because we are sick of the news just happening to us. And really, why would you pay attention to it if we're not going to do anything about it? So today we're going to talk about a bunch of different things. I'm not entirely sure what. It's the first couple of episodes. We're just learning by doing. So Tom C is going to kick us off today. Tom C, what's been floating your boat? What's been tickling your fancy in the news this week?
The word of the week is growth. Ah. And you just keep saying growth until it happens. This seems to be the strategy of the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, who apparently was going into a meeting in Parliament last night, literally on her way in, clapping her hands together and chanting growth, growth, growth. This is the government's approach to getting the economy moving again, is just to say the word growth over and over again like a magic word until
like
it happens.
Like a football fan. I'm
like
into
a football
it.
Fan, yeah. Yes, you know, as long as you chant, like, the ball will go in the goal, just like the growth will go up the goal hole.
Hasn't helped my team so much recently, but anyways.
But yeah, this has sort of come in the context of there's going to be yet another emergency budget style statement today from Rachel Reeves. In particular, it seems announcing that they are going to greenlight Heathrow expansion for runway of Heathrow, which has always been one of these issues, which has rightly been flagged as a massively catastrophic plan for the environment, not really particularly good for growth, but a kind of shibboleth of people who like to say that just getting things done is the way you produce growth. And it's sort of in the context of how there's really sort of nothing going on in the British economy generally. And a lot of these comments about productivity, about how to make money, how to get the economy flowing, is based on the fact that the country just kind of isn't working in general. Infrastructure's collapsed, wage growth has stagnated or in fact gone down in real terms. And there's just sort of a sense that, you know, the government really doesn't have actually any plan for growth, even growth for the sake of, you know, wealthy people and industrialists and corporate owners, let alone growth for people who are barely having enough money to put together to pay the bills. But I think that the Heathrow statement and literally chanting and clapping growth on the way in has kind of come in the context of a lot of other stories. So, you know, Labour had a plan to, on the way into government, they were going to fix the non-dom tax loophole. So people who live and work in the UK but are registered overseas, I think that's something like £3.2 billion a year that we're not getting in taxes from people who are registered as non-doms. Labour were supposed to be fixing that. And now just this week, Rachel Reeves just turned around and said, well, we've listened to the concerns of the non-dom community. And actually, we think it wouldn't be a good idea to tax these people who have been expropriating wealth from the public and disappearing with it overseas without paying any taxes. We're going to roll back on that. There's the cuts to disability benefits that they're now planning, which again is like, if you are going to go after money, why would you go after rich people? You may as well go after people on long-term disability and sickness benefit to force them back into massively underpaid, unproductive, hugely alienating, isolating kind of work, because that's how you get growth in the economy. There's all sorts of statements flying around from like the ex-CEO of BrewDog saying that Britons are lazy and don't appreciate success. And I think, well, there's a reason for them to not appreciate success and resent rich people, is because they don't have any success and they're watching all the rich people walk away with their money. So it's just sort of been an interesting week for seeing all of this classic kind of discussion about how do you get an economy working, and none of it being based on paying people a fair wage, giving them kind of a stake and a hope in that the work they do is going to provide a decent living for them and their families. It's all about how can you skim back the bare bones of any kind of public economic infrastructure that would help ordinary people, and how can you ensure that as much wealth and growth and prosperity as possible is funneled out of people's pockets into the ultra wealthy and out of the country. In this case, out of the country on hundreds of more jets that couldn't soon be landing at Heathrow thanks to the expansion of the third runway.
So yeah, great. So we've got a rerun of Cameron Osborne, which devastated the economy even by their own standards. It wasn't just horrendous for everyone to live through, which is really the thing that we should focus on. But even by their own standards of, say, creating growth, it just created stagnation and destroyed our productive capacity, our ability to make anything, or for there to be any confidence for anyone who's investing in this country that anything would get done or that there'd be any support for it, because, you know, there's no money here, or the money leaves, or, you know, these extremely expensive surveillance state operations that would be used against, say, disabled people, which will give powers to the state to do things against all of us. It gives the power to the state, for instance, in the bill, to for the government to take control of your bank account. That's not something I want them to be able to do, because who's to say, we're only going to do it to quote-unquote disabled people? Well, first off, no, leave them alone. We shouldn't have to make an argument beyond that. But also, that could happen to anyone. You give the government power to do things. It's like the death penalty. Some people think, hey, you know, I really think there's certain people who deserve death for certain crimes. I can understand the emotionality around that. But the reality is, if you give the government the power to kill people, they will kill innocent people. That is proven 100% of the time. They will kill innocent people. If you give the government the power to take control of bank accounts, they will take control of the bank accounts of quote unquote innocent people, which, quite frankly, let's face it, everyone is in regards to this. And it's extraordinarily expensive to do. So the benefits to the taxpayer are minimal, if at all, maybe none. The only kind of growth you've created is creating, again, like a bureaucracy of sort of grasses and snoops who...
Yeah, and you create this kind of, you know, false economy of, you know, in order to administrate these hugely punitive and authoritarian measures, let's get Serco and G4S in to manage them, who will obviously charge extortionate private rates in order to run their vans around town, picking up disabled people or turfing them out of their homes, or, you know, taking them to employment checks to say, well, you may have lost both your legs in a horrific industrial accident, but what's to say you couldn't go back to work? Or, you know, get off your fat ass and start going back to work, you legless freak.
Yeah,
thanks for giving us all your public money for telling you to do so.
And G4S don't pay tax in this country again in many respects. You know, like in some cases they're not. Go and research it yourself. Sorry, just for factual accuracy. But it seems that they don't seem to pay very much tax in this country. And certainly it was reported, just as an example, that they always seem to overcharge the taxpayer by a huge amount, by a factor of 10 or 100. So just as an example, 10,000 employees at the 2012 Olympics, they charged the taxpayer £65 million for the uniforms. And you think, well, what's that? That's £65,000 per uniform, right? What uniform costs £65,000? Our PM, who's getting, gifts for his clothing, isn't seeming to get that amount. So, I mean, you know, I wouldn't mind £65,000 worth of uniforms, but not only did they obviously just get boiler suits that cost, you know, 20 quid from Lidl, but they didn't
get
even
boiler
manage...
suits at Lidl. I'm going there right now. As soon as this call's over, I'm getting my own Lidl boiler suit.
So, you could get anything at Lidl. That's the
yeah. Little side point, by the way. All my
this
mates
podcast
who do
sponsored by Lidl.
Just all my mates who are like climbers or outdoors people. They get all their stuff at Lidl. Like, there's a big central aisle, and you just get all your walking boots. But not only was it just boiler suits, they didn't even manage to hire the 10,000 people. They only got around about 6,000 people. So they charged £65 million, not even for 10,000 people's uniforms, for 6,500. So they've kind of stiffed the taxpayer every which way. In the end, by the way, because G4S was so terrible at hiring people that they were going to clothe so magnificently, we had to call in the army to do a lot of the security work. Again, another burden to the taxpayer. And you see this when G4S runs any of these services, any service pretty much. It's a terrible service provider in almost every aspect. But when it comes to, you know, doing this sort of surveillance state or sort of administrative punitive stuff against the working poor and the disabled and so forth, it's not only an unpleasant, unproductive, counterproductive sort of act in of itself, but G4S execute it terribly at extraordinarily high costs. And we're just going through a rerun of that. I mean, obviously, there was a lot of this going on at high levels during the pandemic as well. It's never gone away. It's a core part of the state. But you have to ask yourself, like, growth for who, for what? Like, when we look at, for instance, the two most recent companies to break £1 billion valuation and to enter the FTSE 100 that are UK companies, on is Raspberry Pi, which is a small tech company, British tech company, that makes like tiny laptops that are available for 50 quid, which, you know, check it out. The CEO quite famously works from about 9:30 till 4:30. Like, his entire ethos is, you know, I like to spend time with my family, right? It's not, crazy sort of American capitalism on steroids. You need to work 7 days a week, 25 hours a day. If you're not doing that, what are you, a wuss? It's not that. So you can build wealth by, like, simply innovating, doing some work and stuff like that.
Which is the complete opposite approach to the BrewDog founder, who was in the news this week talking about how the British public are work-shy wretches who don't appreciate the value and brilliance and godlike nature of business owners like him. And then you go to a BrewDog pub and you see that all the staff are grossly underpaid, unfairly treated, the beer's crap, the atmosphere is completely the opposite of what you would want from any pub.
So bad. It's so bad.
And that's productivity. That's the growth that Rachel Reeves is clapping for.
Yeah. I mean, it's what, you know, what he wants is everyone to live miserable lives, so they have to drink themselves into oblivion in a soulless establishment like his. You know, really, this is really hardcore marketing technique that he's got going on, and not like an attempted rerun of Arbit Mac 3, which I'm not going to explain. But for those of you who know, I think during the height of austerity, one of the Conservative ministers, check this out, I may be incorrect, did use the term work sets you free, which was famously put above certain other places, which we don't really want to discuss. Anyways, the other company that's broken £1 billion and is in the FTSE 100 is Games Workshop, of all things. And Games Workshop is just like, this is something, as much as it may seem like bizarre to a lot of people, like people collecting models to paint them or reading books about a fantasy universe or a sci-fi universe, this is an extraordinary global phenomenon that's now getting TV series and computer games and you know, potential films and animations and all sorts of things. And it mostly comes out of human beings, particularly in Britain, a cold, wet country, spending a lot of time doing something silly and fanciful. And actually, when you look at Britain's greatest industries, it's about having time to do those things, whether it's football, whether it's music. You know, I think Primal Scream famously said that they hated Thatcher, but the one amazing thing that she did for the country is put everyone out of work so that all they had to do was make music, right? And that was back when you had better unemployment benefits, right? Like, and we had this explosion of creativity in the 80s and 90s, you know, that still reverberates around the world and certainly culturally today. So the BrewDog person is obviously not only a miserabilist who's clearly got a fetish for, you know, self-flagellation, but it is also incorrect. Like, really, our greatest economic growth comes from, oddly enough, industries that require you to have spare time, have free time, you know, to squash down and pressed upon at all points. You know, I think so, even by their own terms, this is, you know, incredibly misguided. It's, you know, a sort of generous way of, you know, describing it. And overall, it's not only mean-spirited, but is, you know, facile and stupid. And as you say, ultimately, is just some cheerleading and will not lead to any productivity. It doesn't seem to be, like, functionally anything productive. In fact, the only part of their growth agenda which was universally popular and would have helped is closing the loopholes for non-DOMs. That would have helped. It would have brought money back into the economy that could be used to be invested either by the government, or they would have to, you know, keep it.
I'm going to need more context for non-DOMs.
So non-DOMs are people who...
It says non-domiciled. So these are people who live and work in the UK, but because they are officially domiciled in another country, there are tax loopholes available to them to pay less tax in the UK. So Lord Rothermere, the owner of the Daily Mail, is famously a non-dom. So even though he is a British aristocrat from a famous British aristocratic family, owning British newspapers, running major British businesses, because he is based in insert country here. I can't remember if it's one of the Channel Islands or France.
It's Monaco.
Yeah, Monaco. One of these tax havens where you only live there if you're avoiding paying tax in another country. Because that's where he is officially registered, he's able to avoid significant amounts of tax in the UK. And Labour were proposing, when they were pretending to be a party that actually wanted to change stuff in this country, we will finally fix the non-dom loophole. The Tories have allowed it to fester for years and years and years. There's billions of pounds, £3.2 billion of tax disappearing every year from people who are registered as non-doms. We're going to turn it around. And now, of course, as soon as the millionaires get on the horn to Rachel Reeves and say, we're going to leave the country if you actually make us pay tax in the country where we're employing our workers and exploiting them and taking all the tax away, then we're going to leave. And of course, Labour has buckled because they can't stand the thought of not being popular with a bunch of very, very rich people.
Yeah, who because they're refusing to close the loopholes around party donations, they're hoping that they can rely on to donate to them if Elon Musk donates to Farage, you know? Domicile, by the way, means home, so...
Yeah, no, I knew that.
No, just for the audience, you know, like, we do like to come up with overly technical terms for someone who's, yeah, not housed in this country, theoretically. I think you have to go and live in the other country for like a month a year or something like that, maybe a couple, 2-3 months a year overall to truly be considered a resident of that country and then pay tax there. But, you know, yeah, it's how a lot of wealth flies out of the country. And then the argument is, and you'll see this actually if you watch The Rest is Politics, is Rory Stewart's always go, but the rich might leave, they might leave. To which, you know, you might have heard of Gary Economics, Gary Stevenson, who is one of the most successful traders in the world, who does his economics channel. He talks about, and a lot of people talk about, a wealth tax, because wealth can't leave. I mean, people can. To be fair, by the way, generally speaking, when studies have been done on these things, there's little to no amount of people that actually ever leave, particularly because they, you know, their wealth is built in the country that they're paying tax in. But particularly if you do a wealth tax rather than just an income tax is like what money you make and you pay yourself as a wage if you're a big director. If you tax wealth, houses, land, businesses, those can't move anywhere, and they are here, and that the wealth that they are creating is being created by the country. So these are like a lot more potentially profitable tax, but also something that you could do without fear of quote-unquote capital flight, I think. Let's round this up with a couple of things that people can do about this. I've got a couple of ideas, but before I chuck them out there, Tom C. Mercedes, what do you reckon?
Well, I reckon, you know, there's a lot to talk about around Heathrow third runway, disability cuts, in terms of just basic action to oppose these things, whether that is stopping the construction of the third runway, protesting it, making sure that all of the obvious catastrophic environmental consequences of it are made very clear. Disability benefit cuts, supporting people who are going to be impacted by this, who are going to have their livelihoods worsened even more by effectively being forced into work that doesn't pay them very well, doesn't benefit them, doesn't liberate them from the circumstances that they're in. But I think in a sense of the news and the way that growth in economics is talked about, I think it's always just putting these kinds of human stories to these nebulous fantasies and, you know, magic spells about if you chant growth often enough, it's going to happen. A lot of what comes out, you know, you get this household economics argument, which is, oh, you can't overspend on your credit card, so why should a country overspend on its debt? You know, all these fatuous terms like we need to kickstart the economy. And it's like, well, you can't kickstart an economy that doesn't have an engine, because there's been no investment in jobs, wages, basic infrastructure. And also, you know, with the third runway thing, it's like, yeah, you can get a private company to build a big sign on your house that says, come visit my house. But if your house doesn't have a working kettle or floors or it's flooded, like, people are going to fly into your house via the new, you know, in this overborn metaphor, Heathrow third runway on your roof. And they're going to look at your house and say, it's shit. There's nothing here. Why should I come? So you've built this third runway and you encouraged all these hundreds of extra flights to destroy your breathable air over most of West London. And then all these rich people show up and say, well, I'm here now, I'm going to expropriate the wealth and I'm going to leave again. That's not growth for anybody in this country. It's a lot of growth for the people flying in on all the extra jets on the third runway. But it's not, especially in the overborn household metaphor, not good for your house and not good for the people living there.
Okay, beautiful.
I love that metaphor. It's the best metaphor. Fantastic. I, like, understood you. I think I have more of a question. Like, what is the alternative? What do we do? Yeah, that's kind of where my head's
at. Yeah, I mean, look, there's broader things, right? Like you could entirely change the economic system. There's talk of things like donut economics and other more democratic participatory economics, where you mutualize a lot of the economy, turn a lot of the economy into cooperatives that people co-own and stuff like that. And I'd encourage everyone to read up on those and join cooperatives and support them and stuff like that. But immediately in this kind of like way of doing things that we currently do, there is a very simple thing, which is particularly in a country like ours. Ours is basically a consumer economy. We don't produce huge amounts. Like the majority of the economy is services, which is us providing services to each other and to the rest of the world, because we've got rules on like how we provide services. If you give more people more money, they will spend more money on services. They will buy more Games Workshops and stuff and get Raspberry Pi computers, and they will make more money and hire more people who will have more money to then buy stuff. Kevin Bridges does a really great bit. He's a Scottish Glaswegian comedian.
I fucking love Kevin.
He's a top lad. And he does a great bit, which is a comedy, but it's an actual economic theory, right? He says, instead of taking the money away from people on the dole, give them more. And he does it as a joke. He says, like, because he's going into the local economy, because if you do buy fags and booze, which a lot of people, by the way, are like maligned for, but why shouldn't people be able to have treats, particularly if you're in a desperate situation?
Yeah. Or flat screen TVs. You know, flat screen TVs have always been like the sort of right wing scare story about people on benefits. Like, flat screen TVs are like one of the cheapest consumer goods you can possibly get now. It's not like in the 90s when it was £2,000 for a 500 kilogram CRT TV. And it's begrudging people in the most difficult economic circumstances for having something to watch a bit of TV on in the evenings in between their disgusting Amazon warehouse shifts, or, you know, grinding through the day, suffering from whatever debilitating illnesses they have that keep them out of more stable work. No, you can't have a TV, you can't have fags and booze. Yeah. You know, there was a Tory MP who proposed, like, basically a benefits credit card, which would basically, instead of giving people cash in their bank accounts to use to support their own lifestyles, it would restrict them to only being able to buy certain foods and certain brands. So there's this hugely punitive sense of people on benefits are basically prisoners who don't deserve to have a life of their own unless they are being quote-unquote economically productive.
Yeah, and they're treated as subhuman. And so there's a moral aspect to this, right? And I think what we should be doing is making the argument that it is immoral, but also that it's impractical. It is counterproductive to take money out of the hands of the poorest. The poorest spend their money. The richest sit on it like Smaug the dragon from The Hobbit, right? Like, and they clearly funnel it out of the country. So when you give money to the rich, it doesn't go back into the economy. It doesn't create growth. It does the inverse, usually, right? Very rarely creates growth. Whereas if you give poor people money, not only are they spending it on bags, on fags and booze, they're spending it on food, and they're spending it on necessities and some cheap consumables, right? All of which goes to the shops, goes to the shop workers, goes also... all these goods are heavily taxed, so they go back into the economy. And it's widely now accepted in sort of global charity terms that the best thing to do, and again, this is something Rory Stewart will say, and he's a conservative, is instead of giving money to charities for charities to do the work for people, give people money directly. They can start up small businesses, they can pay each other, it puts more money into their local economy. The counter argument is do you create an inflationary spiral because there's too much money in the economy? Again, giving money to ordinary people to spend on things that they need and want, it isn't a devastating thing. You can, in this paradigm, go too far, but at the moment, the way that you would solve the problem if you want growth is to tax the rich and give it to the poor. Do a bit of Robin Hood. It's not just morally correct. It happens to actually produce growth. And if you want growth, ordinary people having some money to spend on things and more taxes as well will give the government more money that they can invest, and it will give companies that produce things more money. And so that's the thing that you want to be promoting. And just on how we do that, I think Heathrow is a really good example of something that you can do. There's an area of land nearby that I think is still squatted called Grow Heathrow, and so they squatted some of the land that should be built on by the airport. Go and support that, go and help. They actually have community gardens there and people live on that place. They've turned it into a productive area of land for the community. You know, there's a lot of local community activists there that oppose it. They don't want a third runway. It's already hard enough living next to one of the biggest airports in the world. A third runway will be devastating for the local community. Again, negligible economic impacts. Write to your MPs, do petitions, join local environmental groups. And if you're in a trade union, get your trade union branch to sign motions to go to the national thing saying we oppose to this. And tag it onto stuff saying we want more workers' rights, better wages for workers, and we don't want taxpayers' money and so forth being wasted on infrastructure that will destroy the environment and create no economic growth. Instead, invest that money that they're going to put into Heathrow into trains and public transport, which we desperately need, keeping it cheap, making sure that we actually have trains that run on time and buses that run on time. You want your trade union branch to be making those arguments as well, because the Labour Party does have to listen to the trade unions a little bit more than most.
So real.
Sick. All right. So we'll move on to the next one. This should be a little bit quicker because in many ways, media technology news is basically non-consensual doom, right? My friend said, I'd just like to get off Instagram because I was getting non-consensual doom. It's unfair. Like, I don't want to live my life like this. And I think that's the energy we all need to take into 2025. I don't consent to this doom, and I don't want and I don't want it fire hosed into my eyeballs every time I look at my phone. I might do something else, do some grounding, touch some grass, you know, like, I don't know.
Hug a tree,
man. I don't know. People who are doing it seemed happier. I might give it a go. You know, there's other things to do. And we'll talk about what we do about this terrifying media and tech news. It's not so terrifying this week, though obviously the backdrop of what we reported last week is horrendous. But Nvidia lost 50% of its value in one day on the stock exchange. Blair, what does that mean? Like, absolutely nothing. Who are Nvidia? What? Why should I care? By the way, its value is somewhat recovered now at the time of reporting. We'll see what happens. What caused this is the Chinese company, for about $6 million, which is less than the owner of OpenAI's car costs, made an equivalent, in fact, slightly better version of ChatGPT for $6 million. They spent billions on creating ChatGPT.
What's it called?
It's called DeepSeek. And DeepSeek is slightly better. It has some censorship problems. Let me be clear. If you try and look up what it is Tiananmen Square on DeepSeek, it will not answer you honestly. So there will be certain things, because it is a Chinese company, that it will cover up. But let's be real, that's not dissimilar. There are certain things not quite as obvious that US AI companies also filter out as well at their platforms.
Can I create a profile now?
You can create a profile now. You can get a
I've just got a pop-up that says, due to large-scale malicious attacks on DeepSeek services, registration may be busy. Please wait and try again. Registered users can log in normally. Thank you for your understanding and support.
I was going to bring this up, so you brought up something quite interesting. So they created this cheap version that's seemingly slightly better with some censorship issues. I'm going to mention that. What is really interesting is that they open-sourced the code. Now, I met some tech people. They explained to me that open source doesn't always mean what we think it means, right? Like, because it's not always as open and free to use as you think. Nonetheless, basically what they have done is taken stuff that OpenAI had created and were keeping to themselves and saying, we need $500 billion worth of investment into our proprietary special technology that only we own the secret source for. And this other company have only come along, done it cheaper and better so that it can run on your computer with almost no processing power, because they don't have access to those really expensive, amazing chips because the Americans stopped exporting to them as part of their security trade war. They said, you can't have the really good chips. So they said, well, we'll build something better on cheap, shitty chips with less processing power. And they've done it.
Does that mean less water being wasted?
Less water being wasted, less energy being used, less pollution being done. They've innovated like crazy. And then to really stick it to the Americans, they said, here's the code. Anyone can build their own version using our code.
Gotta love the nerds.
And in this case, what's interesting, though, is that back in the day, American nerds would have been doing this. The American nerds would be saying free speech, share stuff, open source, you know, white label everything, make sure everyone can access all information. And the tech bros have come along, Zuckerberg, Sam Altman and OpenAI, Musk and so forth, and said, no, we don't share any of our technology with anyone. We don't want humans to advance. We don't want to share like our learnings, our mistakes. We certainly don't want to let people know how much of this we're letting the American security services control. We don't want anyone to know that. So we're keeping it. And here's the quid pro quo. The American government gives us huge amounts of money through tax breaks, through direct investment, through investment subsidies and stuff like that. The tech companies then invest a small amount of that back into lobbying and essentially legally bribing politicians, and then take the rest of that money for themselves to build technology that they then sell to you and me for $20 to $200 a month, right? We have to deal with that and deal with having to pay for something that essentially the taxpayer has paid to build, and seeing the taxpayers' money not only go into building something that we now pay for and give the private profits to them, but when we're giving them the private profits, some of that money is going to the politicians, which they bribed. It's a brilliant circular economy. That's what they do. What is being shown up by this, it's not just that there's a stock market crash. You know, we can't judge everything by stock markets. And a lot of tech companies are often overinflated. The last time there was a stock market devaluation of this level, it was Meta, the owning company of Facebook, having the largest single day drop in history as well, because often tech companies are overvalued. There's a mechanism by which they're valued at 10 times the amount of normal companies, I think. So you can check that out again. That's by the by. What really is the meat of the story here is that China is competing on the world stage in tech terms with less resources, less access to physical resources, chips and technology, and is actually saying to the US, we believe in globalization, global shares, sharing of technology, and in collaboration. And America, which owns these massive social media companies and tech companies, is saying we believe in global dominance, social media imperialism, in controlling what you see, think, and also the mechanisms, the devices that you see these things on. And we will get you addicted to them, and we will make sure that you have non-consensual doom pouring into your eyeballs every day. And so I think that's what this story tells us. It's just another example of like, of what we were talking about last week, which is American sort of tech imperialism, but also about what it could be an alternative. And again, I don't think we should be relying on the Chinese. There will be a level of Chinese imperialism and government state ownership. There's a level of censorship in these things, but it does highlight that these systems can be as quickly broken as they are made. Right? Because this announcement, DeepSeek, dropped shortly after the government had announced $500 billion worth of investment, the biggest single round of investment into these three tech companies doing this one mega computer farm AI project together. And just shortly after Trump is inaugurated, which you've got to think was probably timed to make him and them look bad, right? So you get this shock and awe approach, and that's what they've literally called it. We're going to try and shock and awe you and tell you there is no alternative. Trump's way, big tech's way, this is it. And DeepSeek comes along and says, nah, you can do different things with almost no money, right?
Go off, King.
So last week was bad news. This week, kind of fun news. What do you think about that? Any questions or thoughts before we move on to the final topic of the day?
I kind of wanted to come back a bit on you saying that, you know, changes in the stock market don't matter. But I think in this instance, changes in the stock market are core of what is happening in this AI bubble. Like the fact that a cheap and easy and quick and still very wonky and not particularly useful Chinese alternative to the US companies causing such a giant crash in the markets overnight shows just how much of this whole tech boom is based on financial speculation and on all of these tech giants like Sam Altman or Mark Zuckerberg or, you know, the other AI creators coming along and saying, if you just give us another couple ten of billions of dollars, we promise we can solve all of your problems in the economy. We'll be able to get people out of work. We'll be able to streamline all of these processes, create all of these fantastic new technological routes. Just keep giving us money. Just keep speculating on the market. Keep bringing in all this private capital. It grows and grows and grows and grows. Like, the actual underlying technology has some kind of, like, gimmicky utility. But the sort of things that they are promising will simply never be delivered. And so when it turned out that there was a massively cheaper alternative that does the same things on a much simpler, cheaper level, there was like a moment of, oh my God, is this bubble going to burst? Is all of this venture capital money that we've been sweeping into the market going to disappear? And of course, as long as the governments back it up and say, you know, how dare the Chinese steal our technology, completely sort of ironically, blissfully unaware that most of US AI is based on stealing people's content, stealing art that's been made by other people, turning it into slop, cannibalizing itself to produce more slop that's less and less relevant to people who are trying to use it. Like, as long as there is always a kind of government interest in backing up these great big speculative bubbles, then AI is going to continue to attract all of this money, continue boiling lakes, continue buying up all of the graphics cards, which I need to play my video games. All of these AI and Bitcoin miners are stealing the graphics cards I need to play my video games, and they're burning the planet in the process, right? But, you know, for me, the thing about DeepSeek is, like, it temporarily exposed that this is a house of sand. Right, it can in a second completely disappear. The actual technology that's being produced, it's completely separate from the money that's going into it. It is just a massive speculative financial bubble.
And it is interesting because if you think about it, these are the kind of things that we've been saying. Outside of the horrendous, like, sort of stealing of everyone's content, of the entire internet's content to build these large language models, at the moment they are glorified chatbots, you know, and web scrapers. Right. And what I mean by web scrapers, so their chatbot, they'll talk to you. You've done it with customer services 5 years ago. So, like, you know, this isn't wildly new. Or they'll look on the internet for you and bring you back results like that. That's ultimately currently the bulk of what AI does. Now, having said that, there are potentially incredible or earth-shattering uses to this, and we'll discuss those in future episodes, but at the moment it's just robbing other, you know, the commons, right? And the commons in this case being the information commons, all the information that we've shared with each other as a species over the past 25-30 years has been robbed by these people to create basically a glorified chatbot, and then to say to everyone, isn't this incredible? Aren't we incredibly valuable? And as long as the government backs them up, I think there's another issue here, which is about monopoly. You know, when we were talking about inshitification last week, you know, the aim is to become an unopposable monopoly, right? And so if the government helps these tech companies become monopolies so that they can run a cartel, they can charge whatever they like for the tech that they lead on, and they can lie to everyone, including their investors, on how much it costs. Or what happens with monopolies is they're not even lying about it. It's just that monopolies are incredibly inefficient. They don't innovate very well. They don't create things because they don't need to, because they already own the market. And so, and they certainly don't create in an efficient way. Like, they don't work out how to do a lot with a little, because they can do a little with a lot. They don't have to do anything. They've got the government backing them. There's no one else around. They've taken all the venture capital money that there is, so everyone else can sod off. And that's a lot of, by the way, what people who look at tech markets say Sam Altman is doing. Is he's specifically going around and getting all the investors to invest in him over any of the other tech companies, specifically so that those companies don't have any money to make anything that could challenge him. Not that his stuff, Sam Altman being the sort of CEO of OpenAI, which runs ChatGPT, not that his stuff is any better, but just he's better at getting the investment. And again, that is the nature of our system. It rewards people who are good at getting money, not particularly good at rewarding people who are good at doing things.
Like, and not doing anything with that money, right? They're good at getting that money and then holding on to it and, you know, turning it into a bubble.
I'd like to say, like, what do they do with that money? Like, let me see these budgets. Like, what? Where is it going?
I would love to see that.
What's happening to...
What do they spend this money on? Who knows? What we do know is that they're largely inefficient. And one of Musk's closest friends recently reported that Musk knows he's not going to Mars. He says things that he knows aren't possible to do. And that, again, I think indicates a sort of mentality amongst these uber elite, you know, tech oligarchs that will just say things to get the money. And then as long as we've got the money, no one else does, you know? So what do we do about this? Well, I like the idea of turning off from any non-consensual doom. I think that should be the title of our episode today. So save your eyeballs and your brain. And remember this, your brain can only do so much in a day. It can only do so much in a life. And if you're filling it with a full of slop that these douches are, like, putting out there to make sure that we don't, like, look at their magic tricks of taking all the money, then we're all going to be poorer and more exhausted and living worse lives. So, you know, that's a sort of personal lifestyle choice, but also institutionally, like, what we probably need to do is form, we need to spend time with each other. And this is something we're going to bang on about episode after episode. It's something that we're going to be doing through forming the News Club Network, is forming a network where you can just spend time with people and do the things that you love doing. It can be anything. It can be watching Love Island or doing pottery or playing Games Workshop or dancing. It can be hanging out and talking about the news like us sad gits. You know, it could be anything you like. I don't recommend it. I think find something better than the news to do, but you could do that. So you can join the network, set up your own setup groups, but spend time with people. From that, other things will grow. But the more we can do that and the less isolated we are, that's one of our antidotes to these bubbles that are being created, you know, on sort of mythical ideas that some kind of technology is going to solve all our problems.
And if none of that works, you can just do what the Chancellor of the UK does and start clapping and chanting, growth, growth, growth.
Yeah, I think if you're doing that out in the streets, you're going to have a different kind of experience.
You're probably going to bring more joy and interest to other people than what the Chancellor is going to manage with her budget statement today.
Why are politicians always so awkward? You'd think it'd be in their job description to actually be capable of emoting or expressing concepts in a human fashion that, like, we can, like, relate to, and they really can't.
Why isn't the Chancellor saying, save your eyeballs and your brain? Like,
yeah. And invest those things in other things that are more productive, that actually makes something of value to the species or to at least the British economy. Because at least, for instance, when you're watching Premier League football in the UK, you're having to pay for it, and that's productive. When you're listening to British music artists or going to gigs, that is productive. Don't think it's not. Our cultural economy, even in the narrow terms of being economically productive, is productive. It's also beautiful and what we need for our souls, that we live rich, fulfilling existences. Anyways, on that point, activism, Mercedes, what's going on in the world of activism?
What is going on in the world of activism? Well, this week, I believe today and tomorrow, 16 political prisoners are appealing their sentences, and there is a lot of solidarity and protest occurring outside of the High Court, in which all of this is now happening. And like, someone I used to organize with finally replied to me on Instagram after.
Is this how we're getting our stories now? Just after I've told people to stop doom scrolling, they're like, News Club brought to you by mates on Instagram.
You say that, but I mean, they're a BBC News podcast presented by their senior journalists, where you can literally see them sat on their phones and talking about the texts they've just received. So,
yeah, okay, yeah, fair enough. So, we're going to emulate that high bar that they've set.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
Someone said on Twitter, like, that's a lot of news reporting. Someone said on Twitter, what, how is this news? Like, something actually happened. It was just some knobhead mouthed off.
But yeah, no, it got me thinking a little bit more about the different paths that we've taken, different lines of activism and organising, and our relationship to direct action and stunts. That's kind of where my head is at, basically.
Shall I explain for the audience what that is? You've been working with us on the News Club network side as sort of community organising, and you've been working community organising and cooperatives for the past few years, whilst your friend has sort of been working on stunts and quote-unquote direct action. It's often called direct action. Sometimes that's a bit of a misnomer. It's more civil disobedience. Direct action fundamentally is targeting the perpetrators of a crime or misdeed directly. So, you know, if you say, like, climate change is caused by oil and gas companies, shutting down an oil refinery would be direct action. If you're trying to raise awareness of something, then it's a stunt. Just Up Oil poured soup over Van Gogh painting, was that right?
Yeah.
Which audience members may have different feelings about. I mean, it's certainly noticeable, right?
It's definitely a stunt.
It's a stunt, yeah. Isn't it? But is it directly targeting the oil companies? Not necessarily. I believe they were, if I'm correct, an oil company was sponsoring that exhibition. Is that correct? Was that why they targeted it? Or were they just trying to gather attention?
I do believe there was probably a little bit more thought than just like, let's go, like, throw it on bank. You know what I mean? I do believe there was probably a bit more meaning.
Yeah, so right, but which we don't know, which, by the way, it's episode 2, we're doing this at 9 in the morning, we're not putting much effort in, but do go and check it out, and actually check out with them, instead of like establishment media reports, which will just talk about the terrible damage done, go and find independent media that will have reported on like what they say their justifications for those actions were, which in the future we'll try and source those for you, or we'll try and put a link in the description. Those are different paths of activism. No, I think it's a good way of talking about how do we change the world. The whole point of this podcast, we're talking about like what's in the news, but what to do about it. You know, what to do is the big question. What do we do? What to do about this stuff? Those are two different paths. And I think they both have validity. I think they both have flaws, right? I think it's worth talking about the flaws in both of them as well as why they're both useful. What would you see as strengths and weaknesses of the stunt type civil disobedience?
I remember when the soup thing happened. I remember it because there was obviously a lot of people that you hear from within those spaces. I'm thinking of a couple of friends in particular who were like in it. and who I think, because they understood their context in which they were doing it, from their perspective, it was always like, pure value, it was great, it was fantastic, the attention, the media, because it got a lot of attention. I remember one time, because this was back when I was on TikTok, this is the bit that really like got me confused, because I was like, wow, I actually don't know what is true anymore. They were essentially talking about the person or people behind that very stunt of throwing the soup at the Van Gogh painting, and that it was essentially sponsored, or in some way, like, the child of some CEO of some oil company of da-da-da. It, like, you know what I mean? It was very, like, a conspiracy theorist response to the whole situation. And then you see, like, the comment section. There's just a lot of misinformation. So where's the value in doing something like that when it starts to, like, buy a bunch of misinformation? And then on the other hand, it's like, well, they got people talking. And that's kind of the point of a stunt, right? What is your intention? What's your end goal? Did you achieve it? So there's also that aspect of it. And I guess they did get people talking, because to this day, I can make that reference and everyone knows what it is. Everyone knows about the stunt.
Yes. I mean, sometimes what you're talking about there is messaging. It either gets lost through some bad comms, or usually through misreporting or editorializing by the establishment media. So they will purposely report on it in a particular way that obscures why it was done. Or you see misinformation and disinformation maybe being put out by bots, maybe by certain conspiratorial type thinkers who are adjacent to the movement or even within the set of people who are doing it. So that's one of the flaws, is even though you can grab attention, not all news is good news, right? Despite the saying to the contrary. You may also garner such negative sort of feeling towards the environmental movement that it's counterproductive. Now, I don't tend to buy that. I think if we're talking about climate change, as we should, as it should be ultimately the number one topic every day, like, that's my personal feeling, if that's what you're trying to do, then this does serve that purpose. These kinds of actions do put it front and center to an extent. But I think where it fails, and this is something that you saw with Extinction Rebellion, where they had predicated their entire movement on, like, getting arrested without the understanding that the reason, the talk that they based that on, was talking about how revolutions, entire social changes, were sort of created when you got up to like 3% of the population, that level of being arrested. I think that was the number, 3% or 1%. The point is to build a mass movement. It's not to get arrested. The point, if you're trying to get people's attention, it's there to get them to act as well. Part of them, the action is getting them to talk about something, which in a polluted information space where we're talking about tripe all the time, is an achievement of itself, and was used by incredible groups like Class War in the 80s in particularly unique fashion. I suggest you check them out. Situationists and surrealists have very much had this kind of impact on public discourse. But ultimately, is it getting us to act on climate change? And I think in both cases, not really. Like, one of XR's demands was tell the truth. The other one was declare a climate emergency. I mean, it's pretty easy to declare a climate emergency. You know, like, you know, these movements, if you are going to do things like this, probably need to include very simple 1 to 3 clear demands and calls to action for the public. And I'd like to see that more. I don't think they should worry about the bad press, though. I think a lot of people, a lot of liberals, a lot of hand-wringers say, there's ways to protest about things and this isn't it. Right, so should we just all go on a walk like Stop the War, where you can just ignore us? Like, the point of protest is not to be able to be ignored. It's not so that you give the police a month's notice in advance so they can reroute the traffic so no one's Saturday shopping is spoiled. The point is that their shopping is spoiled, that they weren't able to do the things they normally do because they had to see you and you disrupted people's day-to-day lives because you were unignorable. So I think those kind of criticisms are kind of weak, you know, but I think the criticisms of having like calls to action and actually creating change, I think those are reasonable criticisms and they need to be incorporated more. If you're going to do stunts, it really has to cause an action. And ultimately, I think, again, as we were coming back to in the last point, it needs to actually bring people together. I think the future of creating change, of news, by the way, information, storytelling, understanding the world, being better, creating a better world, is going to be by people spending time together. And we're not going to be doing it by getting more followers on Instagram, even if our stunt's good, or on Twitter or anything like that. I think those were valid tactics 10 years ago, by the way. I think that helped, because you were able to communicate to all those people that followed you and say, do this thing, do that thing. I think you're going to need to, if you're saying, right, we're throwing soup on this thing, sign our petition. It means we keep your email addresses and we're going to send you actions to do afterwards. Anything where you can directly communicate, that's good. If you do an action, say, you guys get together, do one in your town, or use this as an excuse to spend some time together. That might be useful. You know, it's those kinds of things I think the movement should be thinking about. Right. Having said enough there, Tom C., any final thoughts on activism before we call it a day?
Just very quickly, I think there's always the criticism of a lot of particularly climate action in saying, well, you're only doing this to get in the media. You're only doing this particular kind of stunt because it is a stunt rather than something that is an action that causes change. But I think the way that these actions like throwing soup on paintings or chiseling particular art, you know, displays in museums or cracking open the case of particular ancient relics of world history, I think it proves that when there is not just a climate emergency, like a climate existential crisis bearing over the horizon at us, and all the evidence is there and all the science shows it, and we are now watching outside our windows almost every other week a case of the effects of climate change on basic weather patterns, food sustainability, etc., etc. It's the fact that the only way you seem to get a lot of the media to talk about this, to even address it in passing in some kind of article, is through these stunts. So you're helping to kind of prove a point about the conspiracy of silence around the real effects of climate change, in that you're exposing the complacency and indifference of a lot of the outlets that are supposed to be reporting the truth and informing the public and making them aware of things they might not know about. So I do, you know, obviously there's limits to how far that can go, but, you know, there is still an element of success in turning a mirror on a lot of the mainstream media and showing the fact that the only way we can get you to talk about this is through these stunts is something quite revealing about the way that power and information works in a lot of the mainstream media.
And like virality as well and social media, yeah, definitely.
I think that's a fantastic point, particularly for everyday people to be seen in the media. Even social media requires extraordinary acts. And so this is a mirror, as much as, you know, a call to action on the environment, it's a mirror on the media, as you say, around virality, Mercedes, around the establishment media and how they do things. And that's what they're doing. And by the way, going to prison for it. When we talk about how policing is done in this country and whether we have a truly free country, these are things to consider as well. If we live in a country where we can't express ourselves, communicate to each other or get any attention for really important things without having to end up in prison, then do we really live in a free country with freedom of speech? And that's a question I'll leave for the listener until next time. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Mercedes. Thank you, Tom. We'll catch you next week.
Thank you, lads.
Goodbye.
Banging.